Welcome to Into Africa. My name is Judd Devermont. I am the director of the Africa program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. I was the National Intelligence Officer for Africa and worked at the National Security Council. This is a podcast where we talk politics and challenge paradigms.
On deck today, Zambia has a new president. How did Hakainde Hichilema defeat incumbent Edgar Lungu? And Kenyan courts have invalidated the Building Bridges Initiative. Is it finally time to move on from BBI? Plus, we discuss what an African strategy towards China could look like. What does it mean for loans, trade, people-to-people flows, and transparency?
So whether you have a history with the continent or you're a newcomer, we want to get you into Africa.
Zambian opposition leader Hakainde Hichilema last month defeated incumbent President Lungu at the ballot box. What does this mean for Zambia's democracy in the wider region? Joining me to discuss Zambia and other issues are Cliff Mboya, Africa editor at the China Africa Project, Casey Schmidt, chief executive officer at Voxcroft Analytics, and Hannah Ryder, chief executive officer at Development Reimagined and a CSIS senior associate. Okay, in the early hours of August 16th, longtime opposition leader Hakainde Hichilema was declared the winner of Zambia's presidential election.
There were words that Zambian opposition leader Hakainde Hichilema has waited years to hear.
I therefore declare the said Hichilema Hakainde S to be president-elect of the Republic of Zambia.
His defeat of incumbent President Edgar Lungu came on Hakainde's sixth try for the top office, and his supporters are ecstatic.
This was the country's third opposition defeat of an incumbent since independence in 1964, and it was even more remarkable given that the country had been experiencing democratic backsliding in recent years, and that's something that we have discussed in past podcasts. Casey, if you could just set the scene for us, how did this happen? What does this mean for Zambia going forward?
Sure thing. So for Zambia, I would say Hichilema's opposition victory, it was made possible by a confluence of chronic political and economic crises that kind of steadily became more acute during Lungu's tenure as president. I mean, of course, we all know about Zambia's gross mismanagement of its debt, but also increased levels of corruption, declining rule of law, and political intimidation all became hallmarks of the Lungu administration. And so maybe to embrace my inner James Carville here, you know, it's the economy, stupid. And this confluence of economic and political factors at the time of the global pandemic and crashing commodity prices, you know, that really hurt everyday Zambians and thus became a very difficult election environment for Lungu to defend. And indeed, Hichilema won by a very large margin and made inroads with constituents, you know, far outside his longtime ethnic and opposition base. But now going forward, you know, naturally there's much optimism towards turning the economy around and orienting the country back towards democratization. But Zambia's economic woes are deep, and it's really unclear how patient the Zambian public will be for conditions to improve. And furthermore, Zambia's debt crisis is quite complicated. You know, most of the country's debt is from Chinese loans, and it's unclear how Hichilema's relationship with Beijing will evolve and what China will push for to maintain geopolitical influence there. So we'll see to what extent Hichilema can achieve some quick wins and balance the need for austerity measures, but also coming to the aid of everyday Zambians.
Yeah, I think that's a really good synopsis. I just recently read Nick Cheeseman's article in Africa Report where he talked about, because, as you said, Casey, it was such a dramatic win, right? I mean, in terms of percentages, that it was very hard for Lungu to counter that or block it or deny it. But I think there's also been a number of civil society activists and particularly the courts that made really important interventions at different parts of this process, which prevented Lungu from stealing it. And I have to admit that I thought Lungu was going to take it. He had really weakened the democratic institution so badly over the past 6 years. And I'm delighted to see that that's not the case. And then it sort of makes us think bigger, right? Like, this is the 19th time since 2005 that an opposition leader has an unseated president or an executive prime minister or the ruling party. Actually, that's happened 19 times, but in 17 countries. And so, Hannah, I was wondering, do you have any thoughts on what is the significance of this for the rest of the continent? Like, is this going to inspire opposition leaders? Is this going to give some backbone to chief justices and electoral commissioners? What are the lessons to be learned from what happened in Zambia?
Well, thank you, Judd, as well. Thank you for the invitation to be here, too. It's my first time on this podcast, and it's a real pleasure as well. Coming to your question on what can the rest of the continent learn, I would say in many ways what's happened in Zambia is not necessarily unusual, is what you've just said. I mean, I remember when in Kenya we had President Moi, who after 23 years stepped down very kind of gracefully, unexpectedly in many ways. But it really is kind of testament to the fact that democracy does work in many African countries. And despite, you know, what observers outside might think, and also non-governmental organizations inside, these are processes, and every single country has its own special features. And that's what's most important for us to really understand, rather than a kind of overarching, does democracy work, does democracy not work? And the predictions are really very, very country specific. So, for instance, here I think what was really interesting was the new president had a very strong youth support in the polls. And I think in terms of inspiration, we're talking about inspiration, the idea of reaching out to young people, hopeful presidents want to succeed at the polls, I think that's a very important learning. But on the other hand, it also means that he will have to deliver quite quickly on some of these issues like employment, jobs, and digital economy. And of course, that will be quite challenging if he is under pressure to reduce debt. Now, here I'm going to kind of differ to some degree with Casey in terms of the focus on perhaps China or even, and others are focusing also on IMF. I think one of the two key things that Zambia's new president needs to do is, first of all, speak to others in the region about the international financial environment, coordinate as borrowers rather than speak to creditors first. The first discussion should be with other borrowers. How are they dealing with the COVID-19 crisis, the financing, and all of the economic challenges that is bringing? I think that will be number one. Second of all, he has said that there will be a new debt management office. And again, that kind of learning from what other African countries are doing. For example, Nigeria has a very well-functioning debt management office. Learning from those offices, experience sharing will also be really crucial. So those are two things I think he can do immediately.
Well, so since this episode is going to have a lot on China, especially as we get to the end, maybe we'll just bring Cliff in now, because both you, Hannah, and Casey talked about how the new president, Hichilema, is going to deal with all this Chinese debt. Cliff, since this is your day job and probably your passion, even when you're off the clock, what is your reaction? Where do you sit between Casey and Hannah on this?
I will agree with Hannah to a large extent, because if you watch the trend in Africa, and I agree with her that we are at different stages in our democratic processes. And for me, this wasn't unexpected, really. I know it has been difficult to vote out incumbent presidents for a long time in Africa, but I think the African populace is a different game altogether, especially in recent times, because I think Africans are becoming more demanding to their leaders, and they follow politics keenly, unlike the older days when they could easily be swayed maybe through ethnicity, intimidation. So I think the opposition leaders have been emboldened by recent trends in Africa, and I think they are doing quite well, and the population is becoming informed and more demanding. So I think we should watch this space going forward, and I think opposition politicians have an upper hand compared to incumbents, particularly in a system that does not serve the interests of the people. So we should look out for that going forward.
Well, we'll continue to watch this space, and I think the three of you raised a couple of issues that we're going to be able to talk about in the next segment, which is about Kenya. We've talked about Kenya a number of times on this podcast and almost always about BBI, the Building Bridges Initiative. And so here's just an update for our listeners. The courts have ruled that President Uhuru Kenyatta and former Prime Minister Raila Odinga's BBI initiative was unconstitutional, both on principle and then procedural grounds.
Tonight, the BBI process has been thrown into a tailspin. After a two-month wait, the High Court has finally given its verdict, declaring the entire BBI process unconstitutional.
And so, Cliff, sticking with you, why is this decision important? And do you think this is going to change the dynamics for Kenyan politics?
Well, I think this decision was very important in the sense that first it reaffirms the position of the rule of law in the political space and the independence of the judiciary in Kenya. And if you've noticed, there's been some kind of a pushback against the judiciary by the political class ever since the cancellation and the annulling of the elections of 2017, that is Uhuru Kenyatta's win. And BBI is one of the ways in which the political class has tried to push back, because I think most of them have not moved on to the new political dispensation and the new constitution. But I'm glad that our judiciary has remained steadfast and true to the spirit of the new constitution. And this inspires a lot of hope and confidence within Kenyans who constantly worry about the excesses of the political class, particularly around this time when you're approaching elections. So I think this sets a good precedent for the country going forward. And when we try to figure out what next for Kenyan politics, I'll say that while Kenyan politics can be very unpredictable sometimes, I think luckily, if I can use this phrase, I'll say we have the same monkeys in the same forest, you know. Like, we are exactly a year off the next general election, and we could see fault lines are already showing, and I expect political realignments, adjustments, coalition bidding, and the usual rhetoric that accompanies Kenyan politics. And obviously this comes with those ethnic undertones and intentions sometimes. So I expect the president and his now ally Raila Odinga to regroup and re-strategize. I just hope that with the fall of the BBI, I hope they play by the rules, you know, because at least now we have some sense of predictability in terms of the rules of engagement and the conduct of the political class as well as the institutions. So hopefully they play by the rules and facilitate the next election in a way that will make all of us proud.
I mean, I think what I am hoping for is that we just stop talking about BBI. I said that we've talked about it on the podcast, and it just seems like it just swallows up all of the oxygen when it comes to Kenya. I mean, every newspaper, it's BBI, BBI, BBI. And Casey, I asked you if your company, Voxcroft, who looks at, you know, sentiment analysis, media trends, if you could actually help me either tell me I'm right or wrong, how much is BBI the conversation across media platforms in Kenya? And are there things that Kenyans saying we should be talking about instead of this essentially elite power sharing agreement?
Well, for sure, and not yet. So, I mean, BBI has been, you know, obviously a very popular topic on Twitter and other social media platforms for a while now. And, you know, we just took a look in the last week alone, and there's still thousands of media mentions, and the content is still quite charged, and the narrative is still quite charged. It doesn't seem to be going anywhere anytime soon. Comments like Deputy President Ruto, you know, reported by Nation Africa, and we said that the BBI is the biggest fraud that happened in Kenya. You know, that comment alone this week just circulated and was very popular among many and several influential social media network clusters. But you know, Ronaldo's transfer to Manchester United last week also seemed to be like a welcome distraction from domestic politics.
Yeah, that was all up in my Twitter feed too. I mean, Nigeria, everyone, that was the big issue.
Absolutely. So, you know, maybe that's something that will, you know, break the camel's back and, you know, start getting Kenyans talking about something else.
Hannah, what should Kenyans be talking about as a Kenyan, right? Like, If Kenyatta wants to cement his legacy, like, what are the things that he should really be doing between now and 2022? Like, what's your sense from as a development specialist and where the focus should be?
Kenyatta does have quite a lot of infrastructure projects, for instance, that have been introduced and kind of really progressed while being in office. For example, SGR and LAPSET. There is so much confusion around this. I think definitely being really clear about what the intention and the plan for what those infrastructure projects will deliver and how they will actually impact people's lives positively, rather than this constant narrative of it's just debt, it's just debt. You know, I don't know of any government that is able to run a public train rail link with significant profit. That shouldn't be the key issue. What should be the key issue is how is he contributing to lives through those new projects. I think secondly, trying to bring in policies relating directly to small and medium enterprises, profiting, for instance, from the infrastructure projects, you know, ensuring credit becomes cheaper for small and medium enterprises, these kinds of activities, supporting entrepreneurship in Kenya, where private sector really is so at the forefront of economic activity, but really needs support, I think would be the second. Cliff already mentioned kind of staying on side of on playing with the rules. I think strengthening that the commitment to anti-graft, anti-IFFs as well, the international financial flows, and kind of stopping, really trying to deal with that would be the next. And finally, I think, especially in the context of COVID-19, kind of recovery to some degree, really trying to revamp the social support measures, linking those perhaps with small and medium enterprises. But for example, cash transfers, really trying to support citizens. If he's able to push these sorts of measures through, bring them back. They were at the forefront at the beginning, but kind of withered along the way. Really just bring those. That will create even more opportunities for people and for taxation as well to deal with debt. So I think those would be my suggestions.
I think they're really important prescriptions. And of course, as you mentioned and Cliff alluded to, right, extraordinarily difficult to do in an election season. And the BBI experience, I think, has made it difficult in the year before the election. So we've been kind of stuck in a political loop for a long time. Let's move to our final topic today. I have been waiting to have this conversation for a long time, in part because it's so important to focus on what Africans want and should ask for from China. And it's way too often that U.S. officials, think tank people, including me, I admit it, will sound off about what I think the relationship should be and how it should look like. And it's more important to be listening to Africans and asking Africans to talk concretely about what that relationship should be. Hannah, Development Reimagined in June published From China Africa to Africa China, a blueprint for green and inclusive continent-wide strategy towards China. And it's a great piece that kind of walks through a whole set of recommendations about how African governments or a regional body should think about that relationship. So can you give us some of the key recommendations? And I think the methodology and how you reach that is also useful for our audience.
Sure, Judd. And I'm really glad that you have picked up on it. Quite a few people have. So it's great to have the opportunity to also just explain it in a bit more detail. One of the key reasons why we wrote this was because quite often we're thinking about what should China's strategy be towards Africa, or why does China have a particular strategy towards Africa? Or why does the US have a particular strategy? What should that strategy look like? And actually, it's also equally, if not more important, to think about the agency being with the Africans and Africans saying, what should our strategy be with China? And this actually came up in a retreat which my firm had organized for African ambassadors in China. This was the origination of the idea to publish this what we call a blueprint for this shift. And in that retreat, there was a real sense of, look, we as African leaders, these were the ambassadors, we do want to work strategically with China. We want to have something in which, you know, how do we benchmark this strategy? How do we benchmark our relationship? How do we identify what are the most challenging issues that we really want to take forward? How do we identify what are the most important issues to take forward from our citizens' perspective and from our economic perspective? That was the starting point. It's taken us, till early 2021 to publish it, to get the support to do that. But hopefully it is a great starting point for, in fact, national governments to have significant strategies, ideally public strategies, say what their relationship with China is intended to move to. And the methodology for this particular, for this blueprint is, as the title reveals, continent-wide. So the great starting point is that there is, you know, the continent-wide African Union Agenda 2063. There are also sustainable development goals. So those provide a really key kind of benchmark for thinking about, well, how is China, for instance, contributing to Agenda 2063, which is one of the chapters in the report. We also have another chapter, which I mentioned, benchmarks Africa-China relationship against Africa's relationship with other development partners, for example, in foreign direct investment, in trade, how many trade deficits, all these sorts of questions. Also in terms of concessional loans, aid, and also benchmarks Africa's relationship with China to Asia's relationship, the rest of Asia's relationship with China. How does that look? So there's all these different ways of thinking about it. And the last special part of the strategy, which I think is really worth reading, is the outcomes of the results of some interviews and a survey of African ambassadors in China, which was completed more recently than our 2018 retreat. And that gives some really interesting insights, both in terms of process and also in terms of kind of substantively where ambassadors really focusing. So you find out, things like what provinces are they prioritizing in the relationship? What kind of, is it trade that they care about most, or is it investment that they care about most? Where do they see this going? And so our recommendations then end up falling into those two categories, the kind of substantive recommendations about where the economic relationship should move, taking into account Agenda 2063 and the other types of benchmarks. And also then process-wise, how can African governments coordinate better? And I was talking about Zambia coordinating better, exactly the same idea. How can they coordinate better? We've got the African Continental Free Trade Agreement. We've been coordinating so well when it comes to COVID-19 through the Africa CDC. Be inspired by those and coordinate to improve and take forward the China relationship. So for instance, one of our recommendations is to continue to focus on and try to work with China on increasing concessional loans. That's because we believe that there is a continuous financial gap, which is still a huge financing gap in the continent. China has been a very good partner on that, and so that should certainly continue. But again, we also recommend, for instance, alongside that, much more coordination and within the African continent around the terms of concessional loans, and also on, for example, contractual arrangements, et cetera, debt management, all of those sorts of things. Another recommendation is around trade, to really push for African products to enter the Chinese market. There's lots of reasons why the Chinese market is growing. And this would also link in very much to the African Continental Free Trade Agreement, but we're suggesting in a more preferential way, rather than, especially to manage the challenges of potential new Chinese imports. China already exports quite a lot to African nations. And then I think another final one, which I will pick up, is African governments should do much more in terms of trying to increase people-to-people flows, and not just focusing on students, and although students are very important to focus on, and not just focusing on tourism, but much more from the other side, from China to Africa, but much more in terms of looking at business and professional exchange, more work permits and that sort of thing in China. As somebody that has set up an African firm in China, it's not that hard, but issues around work permits, you know, definitely exist. But it's a great opportunity for students, for instance, to then continue and build that relationship in a much more significant way.
That's perfect. But Casey, your company looks at African media and social media users and how they talk about China. So the things that Hannah just mentioned in terms of her recommendations, right, trade, loans, people-to-people flows, how is that tracking with the way that you are seeing Chinese media talk about the relationship or Africans talk about what they want from the relationship?
Yeah, I think there's some differences in the analysis that comes from our side, but potentially drawing the same conclusions. So to be very clear, you know, my company Voxcroft is, you know, we're focused on capturing and understanding, you know, the voice and opinions of the people. We believe good policy and effective strategic communications, you know, must grasp and integrate what matters most to the people at hyper-local levels. And what matters most to the people often, you know, it's very different than what the African ambassadors to China are going to be recommending. You know, so for us as a company, you know, we're very curious how China's economic engagement in Africa is actually resonating among the public. You know, so we have collected millions of data points from publicly available sources and coded those items for sentiment, and then of course analyzed for drivers behind that sentiment. And certainly at, you know, very macro levels, you know, China enjoys, you know, a very robust media profile in Africa and fairly positive or neutral public sentiment across Africa. But overall, I would say China's resonance with the public is certainly not as strong as I had assumed given the scale of Beijing's economic engagement. And now this was also something that was highlighted in the Development Reimagined report. You know, Africa and its governments and its people, you know, it's not a monolith. And our data doesn't become interesting until you start to begin and drill down into very specific countries and localities. And then you'll see that China's media profile and its resonance, you know, varies widely across the continent and within specific informational environments. So for example, in a controlled media environment like Ethiopia, you know, China's economic engagement is reported on positively almost 100% of the time. I mean, the praise for China is effusive, and it certainly appears Ethiopian media very clearly prefers China as the donor of choice. But in more robust media environments like Nigeria or South Africa, it's much more of a mixed bag with pockets of both positive and negative reporting and media narratives towards China. And then on the social media and kind of a public opinion side, there are multiple competing narratives driving both positive and negative sentiment. And that's happening pretty much everywhere across the continent. And if I were to distill that data into two camps, I mean, really what it seems is that what China is doing in terms of its economic engagement at very superficial levels, like, it resonates very positively among the public. So of course, yeah, like, who doesn't like infrastructure and new roads? What I think is most interesting is the public still seems quite skeptical of how bilateral trade deals are being reached. You know, there's been strong accusations of corruption towards China and lack of transparency. Indeed, we've seen, you know, recent Chinese corruption allegations for road and construction projects in Ghana and Kenya that have gone quite viral in the Twitter sphere. And the public is also quite concerned about how increased trade with China is impacting local businesses. And this whole concept of made in Ethiopia, for the Ethiopian information environment is really strong there. And we routinely see kind of social media criticism towards China's kind of imbalanced trade between Africa and China. And that certainly highlights one of the key findings from Hannah's report, that trade into the African market is quite a good opportunity. I think from a public sentiment and political perspective, you know, African governments and elites, you know, need to be very careful with not just the simple pursuit of increased trade with China, but the manner in which its relationship evolves, the transparency in which deals are made, and the impact that that's going to have on local African enterprises. And certainly, as we've just seen in Zambia, you know, a government's inability to kind of stem corruption allegations at a time of sharp economic decline can quickly become a significant political liability for African governments.
Well, the way that you say it, Casey, sounds like the distance between your analysis and Hannah's, again, is just about transparency, because, you know, there is no disagreement about, you know, trade, loans, people-to-people flows. Those are positive inputs, or those can be foundational parts of a relationship, but just having that transparency is so critical and would allay or address or debunk or reveal where there are problems and when things are working well. And so, Cliff, I'm going to ask you for two questions, because I know you've thought a lot about one around transparency and these issues. So first, just a general reaction to what Casey and Hannah has said. And this is one of my favorite recommendations, Hannah. African countries should make their strategies towards China public. And I think that's a really important recommendation in terms of again, transparency. So, Cliff, you know, what is your reaction to what we've talked about so far? And then this specific issue, do you think they can or should make their strategies public?
Yeah, so definitely. Personally, I think this may be one of the single most important aspects for China-Africa relationship to move forward. And it links to Casey's argument about transparency, you know, because, you know, when they make this public, it opens up a whole new world of opportunities for an even greater China-Africa engagement. And you notice that the China-Africa relationship is too focused on state-to-state relations, leaving out a majority of other actors and the public as a spectator. So making these strategies public will create the awareness needed, first of all, and a general sense of direction, you know, something like a guide that will aid and maybe support participation of these other actors, as well as individuals in their own capacity, so that they can be able to contribute to this engagement. And it also informs other stakeholders on how to effectively align their objectives with government strategy and reap the rewards. So this is the way to go. So I think one area that Africa can really take advantage of and gain a great deal from its public diplomacy, especially targeting the Chinese public away from the state and all, is towards the untapped art sector. For example, our music, our paintings, our sculptures, our movies. You know, these are very powerful tools that have an aspect of influence. They build a reputation in a foreign nation and generally create awareness about the opportunities in your country. You know, China, Africa has been talking about increasing the number of Chinese tourists to the country. There's a research that was done. Most Chinese investors actually first come as tourists. Then during that time, they identify opportunities and come back as investors. So I think we should really improve on our public diplomacy towards the Chinese public. And this will form a basis for implementing the other strategies that we are talking about.
Thanks, Cliff. That's great to add and to complement some of the things that we've been talking about. Hannah, I'm probably opening up another can of worms here, but your report is about Africa's strategy towards China. And you point out in the strategy, the region doesn't have strategies for other developing partners. So are there some of the recommendations that you apply both to China and other foreign partners, including the U.S.? Like, how would you, what are the things in the report that you think are very specific to the China-Africa relationship? And what could be sort of just general principles of the relationship between the continent and its other development partners?
Absolutely. So, but before I answer that question, Judd, you know, one of the key reasons why we publish the blueprint and put it out into the public is that I think the idea of having a public strategy about the relationship with China is so many people say, oh, that's a good idea. But what is the starting point? You know, what does it actually look like? So that's why we wanted to provide something which, you know, can give a structure and a means, you know, to actually envision, if you've got a government, you know, your Rwanda, your Ethiopia, your, you know, many of these governments already do have strategies to some degree, your Nigeria, what could you use? How could you organize a strategy? And how, what kinds of issues should you be looking at in terms of your specific relationship with China? So I think that was exactly that transparency. It's good in principle, but it does need to be backed up with, well, what are you actually going to say? So we're hoping we're kind of contributing to that in some way by having this blueprint. Now to come to your real question, Judd, is this relevant to other development partners? Absolutely. So, you know, the point was not to kind of single out China necessarily, but it's just to say that this relationship is one in which is evolving and which we have a lot of expertise and understanding of. And so here is a document that sets out what that could look like. But definitely, as we were going through doing this, and especially when we were doing the benchmarking of Africa's relationship with other development partners, I think it's exactly these sorts of questions that need to be asked. You know, what does, you know, UK or France, how are you contributing to Agenda 2063? Do you understand what those frameworks are? So I say this in a lot of discussions. I say, how are you contributing to this vision, which is in Agenda 2063, of the African continent being, by 2063, the third largest economy in the world? How is France contributing to that? How is the EU contributing to that? How is China? How seriously are we taking that? How is the US? How seriously is the US taking that? Do investors, when they go to Africa, have that vision? And if you don't, then challenge. Challenge, why not? And I think if you put that to most Africans, I think they would agree that that's a great vision to have. I think it's definitely very relevant. I think it's definitely a means for African governments, African Union, regional economic commissions as well. They can use this kind of structure to benchmark relationships with other development partners too, and take a much more kind of intentional approach. This is the key thing. Be intentional with development partners. This is the time to really kind of develop and focus foreign policy right now.
That's great, Hannah. Let me just thank everyone for joining us today. We're going to put links to the Development Reimagined report in the show notes. We'll also provide some information about Voxcroft Analytics and Cliff's work with the China Africa Project. Thank you guys so much, and we'll see everyone in 2 weeks.
Thanks for listening. We want to have more conversations about Africa. Tell your friends, subscribe to our podcast at Apple Podcasts or wherever you find good content. You can also check out our analysis and reports at csis.org/Africa. Thanks.